greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on House of Bush, House of Saud, right after this message. Well, those who already walk submissively will say that there's no cause for alarm, but submissiveness is not our heritage. The First Amendment was designed to allow rebellion to remain as our heritage, and the Constitution was designed to keep government off the backs of the people. The Bill of Rights was added to keep the precincts of belief and expression of the press of political and social activities free from government surveillance. Now, you know, I wished I'd have thought of that, but that quotation comes from Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas. Now, our princes, our politicians beller in the halls of Congress for more taxes, more spending, and more gun control. And we haven't heard anything intelligent come out of a politician's mouth in more than 75 years. That's why I contend that the only real reason, logic, or common sense left in America comes from our courts, not from the political process, and certainly not from politicians, lawyers, or bureaucrats. Old Mayor Rothschild summed it up with a flair when he said, "You give me the money power, and I care not who makes the laws." Well, let me iterate that by saying, "You give me the judicial power, and I care not who makes the laws either," because the real power in America is in our courts, not in politics. Now, if you'd like to tap into that power of the courts, then call the law school at 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. That's a 4-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. Now, Courtroom Strategy and Procedure is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, go to the website georgegordon.org, click onto the email, and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about a unique book written by Craig Unger, House of Bush, House of Saud. Since 9/11, on September the 11th, 19 Saudi Arabian citizens hijacked 4 airliners and crashed them into targets here in the United States. All of the 9/11 participants were Saudis, not Palestinians, Iraqis, or from some other country. So what's the connection between 9/11 and Saudi Arabia and Saudi Arabia and George Bush? Well, listen to this. On a warm August night in 2002, James R. Bath, he was a little-known Texas businessman, he opened the door to the front of his ranch in Liberty, a town of about 8,000 people on the Trinity River outside Houston. His house is framed by trees silhouetted against a moonlit Texas sky. About 6 foot tall, trim and balding, Bath mingles a wry, folksy Texas charm with some of the machismo of a veteran jet fighter pilot. The combination has served him well in cultivating relationships with some of the great Texas power brokers of the last generation, from former Governor John Connally to the Bush family. There are many ways to tell the story of the events leading up to September 11th and the Iraq War of 2003, and Bath is hardly the most important person through whom to view them. However, his very obscurity carries its own significance, because Bath happens to have served as the intentionally low-profile middleman in a passion play of sorts, the saga of how the House of Saud and its surrogates first courted the Bush family. Bath is disarmingly hospitable as he whips up a late-night dinner and recounts the story of the birth of the Houston-Jeddah connection in the 1970s. A native of Nacogdoches, Louisiana, he moved to Houston in 1965 at the age of 29 to join the Texas Air National Guard. Then in the late 60s, after working for Atlantic Aviation, a Delaware-based company that sold business aircraft, he moved to Houston and then went on to become an airplane broker on his own. Sometime around 1974, Bath was trying to sell an F-27 turboprop, a sluggish medium-ranged plane that was not exactly a hot ticket in those days, when he received a phone call that changed his life. The voice on the other end belonged to Salam bin Laden, heir to the great Saudi bin Laden group fortune. Then only about 25, Salam was the eldest of 54 children of Mohammed Awad bin Laden, a brilliant engineer who had built the multi-billion dollar construction empire in Saudi Arabia. Bath not only had a buyer for his airplane no one else seemed to want, but he also had stumbled upon a source of wealth and power that was certain to pique the interest of even the brashest Texas oil baron. Bath flew the plane to Saudi Arabia himself, no easy task since the aircraft could only do about 240 knots an hour, and ended up spending 3 weeks in Jeddah, where he befriended two key figures in the new generation of young Saudi billionaires. One of them was Salim bin Laden. In addition, Salim introduced Bath to his family and friends, including Khalid bin Mofez, also about 25, who was the heir to the National Commercial Bank of Saudi Arabia, the biggest bank in the kingdom. Salem was of medium height, outgoing, and thoroughly Western in his manner, says Bath. Bin Mufaz was taller, about 6 foot, rail thin, relatively quiet and reserved. One associate says that if he had not known Bin Mufaz was a Saudi billionaire, he would have mistaken him for a biker straight out of Harley Davidson. Bath immediately took the two young men. "I like the Saudi mentality. They like guns, horses, aviation, and the outdoors," he said. "We had a lot in common." In many ways, Bin Mufaz and Bin Laden were Saudi versions of the well-heeled, good old boys whom Bath knew so well in Texas. Down in Texas, you'll find the rich carrying on about being just poor country boys, he says. Well, these guys were masters of playing the poor, simple Bedouin kid. Poor they were not. Salam and Khalid were both poised to take over the company started by their billionaire fathers. In fact, they had almost identical family histories. Their fathers, Mohammed Awad bin Laden and Salim bin Mufaz, respectively, had both originally come from the Hadramaut and oasis-like valley in the rugged, mountainous eastern Yemen. Both men were uneducated and poor. Bin Laden was a brilliant but illiterate bricklayer who never even learned to sign his name. He had traveled the same 750-mile trek by foot. In Jeddah, the commercial capital of Saudi Arabia, they made their fortunes off the Hajj, the sacred pilgrimages to the great mosques in Mecca and Medina. Bin Laden through construction, and Bin Mufaz through currency exchange. In 1931, Salim's father, Mohammed, had formed what eventually became the Saudi Bin Laden Group as a modest general contracting firm that first became known for building roads, including a stunning highway with precipitous hairpin turns between Jeddah and the resort city of Tiff. Ambitious and highly disciplined, the elder bin Laden advanced his cause by submitting below-cost bids on palace construction projects, including palaces for members of the royal family. His shrewdest innovation was to build a ramp to the palace bedroom of the aging and partially paralyzed King Abdul Aziz. Subsequently, the king made him the royal family's favorite contractor for palaces, and major governmental infrastructure projects. As a result of his growing friendship, in 1951, bin Laden won the contract to build one of the kingdom's first major roads running from Jeddah to Medina. Eventually, he became known as the king's private contractor. He was a very nice man, very well liked by the royals, says an American oil executive who knew Muhammad Awad bin Laden. He had the reputation of a doer of getting things done. Now, the most prestigious and lucrative prize given by the royal family of Arabia to the bin Ladens was for the kingdom's biggest roads and exclusive rights to all religious construction, including the $17 billion in contracts to rebuild the holy sites at Medina and Mecca, which carried enormous iconic significance. In the center of the Grand Mosque of Mecca was the Kaaba, the holiest place to worship in all of Islam. Legend has it that the Kaaba was built after God instructed the prophet Abraham to build a house of worship, and the archangel Gabriel gave Abraham a black stone, thought to be a meteorite, which was placed in the northeast corner of the Kaaba. If there is one single image that signifies the Muslim world, it is that of the Hajj being performed in the Kaaba, says Adil Najim, a professor at Boston University. Now, rebuilding these sites would be the Western equivalent of restoring the Statue of Liberty, Mount Rushmore, and the Lincoln Memorial multiplied by a factor of 10. And during the same period that Muhammad Awad bin Laden was cementing his ties with the royal family, Salim bin Mufiz was using similar methods to woo King Abdul Aziz after leaving the Hadramaut in 1915, bin Mufiz had worked in various capacities for the wealthy Kaki family of Mecca for 35 years, finally winning a partnership in the Kaki's lucrative currency exchange business. And because charging interest was prohibited by the Quran, as usury at the time, Saudi Arabia merely had money changers instead of a domestic banking industry. But bin Mufiz went to the royal family and argued that Saudi Arabia would never be self-sufficient until the kingdom had a bank. Subsequently, bin Mufiz won a license that allowed him to establish the National Commercial Bank of Saudi Arabia, the first bank in the kingdom. By the early 1960s, the bin Mufizes and the bin Ladens had made extraordinarily successful transactions and transitions from the tribal Wild West-like Hadramaut in Yemen to the far more commercially sophisticated world of Jeddah, since they were outsiders. Both families were Yemenites. The bin Ladens and the bin Mufizes did not have the tribal allegiances that other Saudis had, and it was easy for the royal family to build them into billionaire allies who did not bring with them the political baggage that other Saudis had. Consequently, the two great merchant families had virtual state monopolies in construction and banking. In effect, the Saudi bin Laden group was on its way to becoming a Saudi equivalent of Bechtel, the huge California-based construction and engineering firm. Likewise, bin Mufiz had begun to build the National Commercial Bank into the Saudi version of Citibank, paving the way for it to enter the era of globalization. Knowing full well the value of being close to the royal family in Saudi Arabia, Salim bin Laden and Khalid bin Mufiz sought to have similar relationships in the United States, with both tutoring them in the ways of the West. They started coming to Houston regularly in the mid-70s. Salem came first, buying planes and construction equipment for his family's company. He bought houses in Marble Falls on Lake Travis in central Texas Hill Country and near Orlando, Florida. He started an aircraft services company in San Antonio, called Bin Laden Aviation, largely as a vehicle for managing his small fleet. He converted a BAC-111, that's a British medium-sized commercial jetliner, for his own personal use, and for fun he flew Learjets, ultralights, and other planes around Central Texas. There were days that began in Geneva, continued in England, and ended up in New York. Salim flew girlfriends over the Nile to see the pyramids. He loved to fly, and he spent more time trying to entertain himself than anyone that I know, says D. Howard, a San Antonio engineer who converted several aircraft for Bin Laden, including the $92 million modification of a Boeing 747-400 for King Fahd's personal use. The biggest such conversion in the world. This spectacularly outfitted jumbo jet boasted its own private hospital and was said to make Air Force One look modest by comparison. From Texas to England, most Westerners who knew the Bin Ladens found them irresistible. Salim was a crazy bastard and a delightful guy, says Terry Bennett, a doctor who attended the family in Saudi Arabia. All of the Bin Ladens filled the room. It was like being in the room with Bill Clinton or someone that you were aware that they were there. They may have had the normal human foibles, but they were good for their word and they were generous to a fault. Salim loved music, the nightlife, and entertaining guests at dinner parties by playing guitar and singing, deep in the heart of Texas. But Khalid bin Mufaz was more reserved. Khalid was a banker first and always acted as a banker, and as a banker should. He was extremely intelligent and quick to assess things, remembers Bath. For the most part, bin Laden and bin Mufaz eschewed the gaudy public extravagance of sheikhs such as Mohammed Al-Fazi, who in 1979 painted his Beverly Hills mansion in a color that evoked rotting limes and redid the statuary so that the genitals appeared more lifelike. Still, this was Texas. Bigger was better. And bin Mufaz and bin Laden observed the prevailing mores, and as they became entrenched in Texas in the 1970s, bin Mufaz bought an enormous rambling $3.5 million chateau, later known as Houston's Versailles, in the posh River Oak section of Houston. He also purchased a 4,000-acre ranch in Liberty County on the Trinity River near James Bath's ranch. These men, both billionaires from a fundamentalist theocratic monarchy, had arrived in a wide-open American city where strip clubs and churches were often found side by side and where they fit right in. They loved the ranch and they loved the country life, said Bath. There was a real affinity between Texas and life in the kingdom. Khalid would come out to the ranch with the family and the kids to ride horses, shoot guns, shoot off fireworks. They'd been going to England forever, but Texas, that was the novelty. Bin Laden and bin Mufaz were not the only Saudis who started making the Saudi Arabia-Texas commute. Saudi arms dealer Adim Khashoggi operated a small fleet of Boeing 727s for his private use. In 1970, Prince Bandar, later the ambassador on the Truman and Balcony with President Bush, trained at Perrin Air Force Base near Sherman, Texas, as a fighter pilot and became a daring acrobatic pilot who delighted in entertaining VIPs with his audacious aerial stunts. Joining them were the future king, then Crown Prince Fahd bin Abdulaziz, the construction magnate, Sheikh Abdullah Barum, and others. There were more private planes for the Saudis than many airlines have, said one pilot who flew for Salim bin Laden. It was quite an operation. Everyone had big airplanes, and we flew whatever had wings. Houston offered them a glimpse of a rapidly approaching Saudi future, and as late as 1974, the tallest building in the Saudi capital of Riyadh was a mere water tower. But downtown Houston was already studded with gleaming skyscrapers. At home, the Saudis shopped in ancient market towns as souks. But in Houston, the extravagantly modern Galleria shopping mall had just opened, and Saudi Arabia was still a feudal desert kingdom where people lacked the professional skills and bureaucratic infrastructure to build a modern economy. Houston, by contrast, had gigantic energy, industry, law firms, Baker, Botts, Vinson, Elkins, and Connolly, Fulbright, and Jaworski, that greased the wheels of America's enormous oil industry so that it could easily navigate the corridors of power in Washington. In many ways, Riyadh and Houston could scarcely have been more dissimilar, yet these differences were precisely what attracted the Saudis to Texas and catalyzed a chain of events over the next 30 years that would change global geopolitics and world history. In part, it was oil that drew the two cultures together. Its history in Texas dated to January 1901, when a handful of wildcatters in Beaumont, Texas, about 60 miles from Houston, drilled away until mud mysteriously bubbled up from the ground and several tons of pipe abruptly shot upward with enormous force. A few minutes later, as workmen began to inspect the damage, another geyser of oil erupted from 3,600 feet under a salt dome. The wildcatters had hoped to bring in 50 barrels a day. Instead, the legendary spindle-top gusher brought in as many as 100,000 barrels a day, and the Texas oil boom had begun. Before long, Houston's ship channel had grown into a 20-mile stretch of refineries, constituting one of the great industrial complexes in the world, where hundreds and thousands of towers and massive spherical tanks spewed smoke and steam, eerily illuminating the ghostly sky like a brightly lit erector set. More than a quarter of all of the oil used in the United States was refined there. Part of the complex, the Exxon Mobil plant in Baytown, is the biggest oil refinery in the world, producing more than 500,000 barrels of petroleum products a day. By contrast, oil was not even discovered in Saudi Arabia until 1938, and even then, and for more than a generation afterward, control of the vast Saudi resources remained heavily influenced by the United States, thanks to lucrative concessions granted to Aramco, the Arabian American Oil Company, a consortium of giant American oil companies and the Saudis. In the early 1970s, however, just before bin Laden and bin Muffaz struck out for Texas, the world of oil underwent a dramatic change. Oil production in the United States had peaked in 1970, and it was beginning an inexorable decline at a time when more people drove more miles in bigger cars that burned more gas. Baby boomers had come of age and were driving. An elaborate suburban car culture had grown up all over the United States. There were Corvettes and Mustangs, muscle cars such as the Trans Am and the drive-in restaurants and shopping malls. The volume of America's imported oil nearly doubled from 3.2 million barrels a day in 1970 to 6.2 million barrels a day in 1973. Saudi Arabia's share of the world export skyrocketed from 13% in 1970 to 21% in 1972. And Saudi Arabia's transformation from an underdeveloped backwater to one of the richest countries in the world was underway. In October of 1973, just after the Arab-Israeli War, OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, a heretofore impotent consortium of oil-rich nations, abruptly became a genuine cartel capable of driving the price of oil up more than 300%. Oil they had discovered could be used as a weapon. Suddenly, Saudi Arabia took on the position that Texas itself had once had and became the swing oil producer for the great industrial nations of the world. The biggest transfer of wealth in human history was underway. Hundreds of billions of dollars in oil revenues poured into the Saudi kingdom. The Saudis were drowning in petrodollars. And not surprisingly, most Americans don't have fond memories of the Saudi ascendancy in the 1970s. With the embargo, the price of gas in the United States jumped from 38 cents a gallon in 1973 to $1.35 a gallon in 1981. Soaring inflation, high interest rates, and long gas lines soon followed. A nationwide speed limit of 55 miles an hour was imposed in the interests of fuel efficiency. Government bureaucracies were established to reduce energy consumption. Houston, Texas, however, benefited from the newfound Saudi wealth more than any other city in the country. And all over the United States, architectural firms cut back because of the recession, but not in Houston. In Houston, CRS Design Associates more than doubled its payroll, thanks to huge contracts from the Saudis. Super developer Gerald Hines built gleaming skyscrapers in downtown Houston, designed by the likes of Philip Johnson and I.M. Pei. Financed, it was whispered, with Saudi royals. Petrodollars flowed into Houston, Texas commercial bank thanks to Arab clients. And Saudi companies bought drill bits and pipes and lubricant in Houston. The price of oil was over $30 a barrel and looked as if it would never fall. And while the rest of the country had to pay the price, Texas oil producers also enjoyed the higher revenues. At last, Houston was on the map of international cafe society. Local societies and socialites hung out at Tony's Restaurant on Westheimer Road, taking a prominent table with Princess Grace, Mick Jagger, fashion designer Bill Blass, or whichever well-known house guest had flown in for the week. In all, more than 80 companies in Houston developed strong business relationships with the Saudis. It was even said that Houston was becoming, to the Saudis, what New York is to Israel and the Jews, another home half a world away. The story that you're hearing, House of Bush, House of Saud, written by Craig Unger, published by Scribner and Company, copyrighted 2004. I rate it a 1 in 100 read. You will read 100 books before you find another one like this. The ISBN number is 07432-5337-X. Again, that's copyright 2004, Scribner and Company, ISBN number 07432-5337-X. I recommend it because it tells us the story of the Saudi-Bush relationship. Why is it that Saudi Arabia, the country where the 19 hijackers came from that attacked America on 9/11, has never been called to account, and none of the people that were spirited out of the United States, 140 of them, in the days following 9/11, were ever questioned? Not even asked what their connections were with bin Laden's and the bin Laden family. It's quite a story. The background begins in Texas. That's where the Bushes and the bin Ladens first met. It's an intriguing story. A story of power, wealth, sex, and politics, world international politics. Now hang on, we'll take a break right here and we'll be back with more on House of Bush, House of Saud right after this break. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, we Americans may hold the dubious honor of being the most litigious people in the world, but when it comes to law, we seem to be among the world's most ignorant. Today, most Americans feel powerless to resist the evils that they see perpetrated against our liberties, our privacy, and our property by these powerful government agencies, the multinational corporations, lobbies, and the news media. But we don't have to remain helpless. The institution designed by God and incorporated into our Constitution, a Bill of Rights, is called the judicial power, and the courts are the proper repository for the protection of our rights, liberties, and property, not the Congress or the political process. Now, did you know that the privilege against self-incrimination is neither accorded to the passive resistant, nor to the person who is ignorant of his rights? Not to one who is indifferent thereto, because it's a fighting clause, and its benefits can be retained only by sustained compact, and it cannot be claimed by an attorney or solicitor. It's valid only when insisted upon by a belligerent claimant in person. That comes from U.S. versus Johnson, and that's why I contend that we should listen more to the judges and less to the politicians, and less to the lawyers. Now, did you hear what that judge said? He said, your rights cannot be claimed by your attorney or solicitor. They are claimed by you, the belligerent claimant in person. Now, if you'd like to learn more about courtroom strategy and procedure, just call me at 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Courtroom strategy and procedures available on compact disc for adult home education. Now, if you're online, go to the website georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request, a request for that free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, on September the 11th, Saudi Arabian citizens, 19 of them, hijacked four airliners and crashed them into targets here in the United States. And all of the 9/11 participants were Saudis, not Palestinians or Iraqis. So what's the connection between 9/11 and Saudi Arabia and Saudi Arabia and George Bush? Well, listen to this. Just like the Israelis, the Saudis had one overwhelming need that they sought in this new alliance, and that is defense. Because for all of its newfound wealth, the House of Saud was more vulnerable militarily than ever. A feudal desert monarchy that lacked the infrastructure of a modern industrial nation. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia had more than 1,500 miles of coastline. Its oil and gas facilities provided numerous high-value targets. And Iran regularly sponsored riots during the pilgrimages to Mecca and provided support to the Shiite extremists in Saudi Arabia. Iraq, with which it shares a border, was a threat. Across the Red Sea, Sudan was a hospitable host to extremists. Other troublesome neighbors included Yemen, Oman, and Jordan. Saudi Arabia was vast. It's about a quarter the size of the United States. But it had to be defended by a population that at the time was under 6 million people, three-quarters of whom were women, children, and the elderly. In addition, the Saudis had extraordinarily internal weaknesses. As the rulers of an underdeveloped feudal desert kingdom, they were in control of one of the most corrupt, authoritarian, undemocratic countries in the world. It was threatened by communists and Islamic revolutionaries. Women had virtually no rights. The Saudis arguably led the world in public beheadings, many of which took place in a plaza in Riyadh referred to as Chop Chop Square. Flooded with petrodollars, the Saudis still urgently needed a partner. And as a result, the kingdom began to weave a tight alliance with the United States, militarily, economically, and politically. And as the petrodollars poured in over the next 25 years, roughly 85,000 high net worth Saudis invested a staggering $860 billion in American companies, an average of more than $10 million per person, and a sum that is roughly equivalent to the gross domestic product of Spain. They took the United States by storm, selling crude, buying banks, building skyscrapers, buying weapons, and investing everywhere. Most important, the Saudis sought strong political ties to the United States through personal friendships with the powers that be. Education, training, and connections with American power brokers became prerequisites for the next generation of Saudi elite. They started sending their sons to school in the United States. A Saudi soil analyst who himself was educated at Harvard and MIT, Nawaf Obid. They wanted to build up relationships with key people at the same time that they had return on their investments. The vast majority of the Saudi investments in the United States went into major banks and energy, defense, technology, and media companies. There were blue chips such as Citigroup and AOL, Time Warner, and huge secretive consortiums such as Investcorp, which put billions of Arab dollars in companies including Tiffany, Gucci, Saks Fifth Avenue. But the House of Saud also made a handful of investments in troubled companies that were loaded with debt and regularly problems, which just happened to be owned by men who had or might have White House ties. The leadership in the kingdom definitely supported these activities, says Prince Turki bin Faisal Al Saud, the ambassador to Great Britain, who long served as Saudi Minister of Intelligence and was a son of the late King Faisal. Super lawyer Edward Bennett Williams, a roguish Washington fixer, understood exactly what the Saudis were after. According to the Man to See, Evan Thomas, 1991 biography of Williams, in the 70s, he accompanied Clark Clifford, a perennial advisor to Democratic presidents and one of the so-called wise men of Washington, on a private jet after Clifford had ill-advisedly taken on billionaire Arab clients. Williams gleefully acted out a pantomime of a delegation of Arabs visiting Clifford in his office, wrote Thomas. Williams, a perfect mimic, imitated Clifford, gravely telling the visiting sheikhs, "You understand, of course, that I can only get you access." Then Williams imitated the Arabs winking and grinning as they shoved a big bag of gold across Clifford's desk. As it happened, Edward Bennett Williams' droll account of the Arab strategy for achieving entry into the inner sanctums of American political power wasn't far from the truth. However, before approaching a man of Clark Clifford's stature, or for that matter, wary Republican power brokers, the Saudis went to someone in Jimmy Carter's White House, someone who not only had access to the president, but who also happened to be desperately vulnerable. After taking office in 1977, President Carter had appointed his close friend Burt Lance, the CEO of the National Bank of Georgia, as the director of the Office of Management and Budget. Lance had played a key role in Carter's presidential campaign, but in many ways, he was the polar opposite of a beltway insider like Clifford. He was not an easy fit in Washington. The media enjoyed tweaking the rumpled 6'5" Lance with his scrumpy southern drawl as something of a country bumpkin straight out of Georgia and out of the Georgia woods. And within weeks of taking his place in the new administration, he was in trouble. Lance had financed much of Carter's electoral campaign through overdrafts at the NBG. And now that he was in the glare of the Washington political spotlight, those transactions had come under scrutiny. In addition, when he became CEO of the bank, Lance had borrowed $2.6 million to finance the purchase of his stock in the bank under terms that required him to remain its chief executive. That, however, was impossible because now that he was in the government, he was required by law to resign from the bank. Worse, bank stocks had sunk so low that Lance couldn't afford to sell his stock to pay off the loan. Last, Lance was charged with having mismanaged corporate and personal financial affairs by pledging the same stock as collateral for two loans and having improperly pledged some of the bank's assets against his loans. So an investigation and trial later found Lance innocent, but his reputation was devastated. In September of 1977, only a few months after he had taken over at OMB, he resigned. Burt Lance was heavily in debt and unemployed. He just had one thing going for him. He was still close friends with the President of the United States. So in October, just weeks after his resignation, Burt Lance met with Aga Haseen Abidi, the Pakistani founder of the Bank of Credit and Commerce International. It was called BCCI. At the time, BCCI was said to be the fastest growing bank in the world. Its assets had grown from $200 million in 1972 to more than $2 billion in 1977. As a bank friendly to Muslim concerns, BCCI was perfectly positioned to take advantage of the petrodollars flowing into the Middle East in the wake of the OPEC oil embargo. BCCI's ascendancy was also due to business practices that were highly unusual in the staid world of banking. Other banks gave toaster ovens to new depositors. BCCI provided prostitutes. Loans of millions of dollars were granted merely on the basis of a simple request. And BCCI allegedly handled flight capital from countries such as India or Pakistan, where currency constraints strictly prohibited the wealthy from taking their money out of the country. BCCI was luring customers away from its rivals and now had 146 branches in 32 countries, but it still had no presence in the biggest financial market in the world, the United States. Now, you cannot be a global bank, an international bank, without some sort of presence in the United States, Lance told BCCI founder Abidi. This is the richest, most powerful nation in the world, and this is certainly something you ought to look at. Desperate to sell his stock, Lance had just the thing in mind, a modest southern bank, namely the National Bank of Georgia. Abidi told Lance that Saudi billionaire Gaith Faran might be just the person to take over NGB. Born in 1940, the dapper Faran was the son of a private physician to King Abdulaziz, as was Saudi billionaire arms dealer Adnan Khashoggi. Faran's education included undergraduate work at Stanford and an MBA from Harvard Business School. He wore Seville row suits and a Van Dyke beard. Like his childhood friend, Khalid bin Mufaz, he was close to the House of Saud and personified the wave of westernized Saudi billionaires who came to the United States in the aftermath of the OPEC oil embargo. With an annual income of $300 million in 1974, Faran had lavish homes in Saudi Arabia and Paris, and a magnificent plantation near Savannah, Georgia, that had been owned by Henry Ford. In 1975, Faran helped pioneer the Arab takeover of American banks by purchasing Detroit's ailing Bank of the Commonwealth at a time when Arab money was a novelty in the United States. Negotiations to sell the National Bank of Georgia to Faran and BCCI began over Thanksgiving weekend in 1977 through discussions among Burt Lance, Abidi, and other BCCI officials. And on December the 20th, Lance announced that he was selling his NBG stock to Faran for $2.4 million, a $20 a share, twice what it had been worth only a few weeks earlier. Why had Saudis paid top dollar for a failing bank that was a target of federal regulators? Well, the Senate investigation concluded that gaining access to President Carter in the White House was one of the reasons that the Arabs were interested in having Lance represent them and in buying his interest in the National Bank of Georgia. The access that Lance offered BCCI was not illusory. Through Lance, BCCI representatives met Jimmy Carter and Reverend Jesse Jackson, Prime Minister James Callaghan of Great Britain, and many other officials, including Lance's attorney and aforementioned Clark Clifford. The Senate report concluded that Carter's integrity was used by BCCI officials as the bank went about mixing bribery and flattery to obtain access to the foreign reserves and other assets of numerous third world countries. As for Lance, who had once been referred to as the Deputy President of the United States, he returned to Georgia to work as a financial consultant. But his career in national politics was over, and as for the Saudis, they had learned that they could win access to the highest levels of power in the United States. Now, on the Republican side, James Bath didn't have nearly the stature of Edward Bennett Williams or Clark Clifford, or for that matter, the visibility of Burt Lance. But in the 1970s in Houston, for Khalid bin Mufaz and Salim bin Laden, Jim Bath was the man to see. He counted among his friends and business associates no fewer than five Texans, four of them Republicans, who at one time or another would be considered presidential candidates. Bath was friendly with the family of Senator Lloyd Benson, the lanky, distinguished Democrat who would run as vice presidential candidate in 1988 and later became Secretary of the Treasury. Bath had become partners with one of his sons, Lynn Benson, in a small real estate firm that developed an apartment complex and airplane hangars and sought investments for the senator's blind trust. While he served in the Texas Air National Guard, Bath had also befriended the young George W. Bush, who had begun training in 1970 as a pilot of F-102 fighters at Ellington Air Force Base near Houston. Bush had been a member of the Champaign Unit of the National Guard, so called because it was famous for serving as the vehicle through which the sons of Houston society escaped serving in the Vietnam War. In the mid-1970s, young Bush also introduced Bath to his father, a former Houston congressman who had lost senatorial races in 1964 to liberal Democrat Ralph Yarborough and in 1970 to the more conservative Lloyd Benson. The elder George Bush had been a devoted Nixon loyalist even through the mire of Watergate. His steadfastness had been rewarded with appointments as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, as Chairman of the Republican National Committee, and under Presidents Gerald Ford as Chief Liaison to the U.S. Mission in China. In 1976, Bush was appointed head of the CIA. Both George Bush Sr. and George Bush Jr. came from Skull and Bones, the Yale fraternity, the think tank. There was also Bath's duck hunting buddy, James A. Baker III, then in his mid-40s, one of Houston's most powerful corporate attorneys and a true Texas patrician. Baker was a close friend and associate of George Herbert Walker Bush. Finally, there was John Connally, the silver-haired, silver-tongued former Democratic Texas governor who became Secretary of the Treasury under Richard Nixon in 1971 and who later switched to the Republican Party. By 1976, Salim bin Laden had appointed Baath his American business representative. Khalid bin Mufaz drew up a similar arrangement with him as well. Baath was more than simply someone who could provide the Saudis with entree to political power brokers, but exactly what he did beyond that in the intelligence world and elsewhere was shrouded in mystery. From time to the Wall Street Journal, the press speculated about Baath's connections to the Bushes, to John Connolly, to the CIA, and to BCCI, and to various figures in the Iran-Contra scandal of the 1980s. When asked about his career, Baath usually downplayed his importance. By his account, he was merely a small, obscure businessman. It was often said that he was in the CIA, but Baath denied that to Time magazine. Later, he equivocated. He said there's all sorts of degrees of civilian participation in the CIA, he says. He runs the whole spectrum, maybe passing on relevant data to more substantive things. The people who are called on by their government and serve, I don't think you're going to find them talking about it. Were that the case with me, I'm almost certain you wouldn't find me talking about it, said Baath. Well, Baath's role in investing for the Saudis took various forms. The investments were sometimes in my name as trustee, sometimes offshore corporations, and sometimes in the name of a law firm, he says. It would vary. And Baath generally received a 5% interest as his fee and was sometimes listed on related corporate documents. On behalf of Salim bin Laden, Baath purchased the Houston Gulf Airport, a small private facility in the League City, Texas, 25 miles east of Houston. He also became the sole director of Skyway Aircraft Leasing in the Cayman Islands, which was actually owned by Khalid bin Mufaz. Through Skyway, Baath brokered about $150 million worth of private aircraft sales and deals to major stockholders in BCCI such as Gaith Farhan and Sheikh Zayed bin Sultan, president of the United Arab Emirates. To incorporate his companies in the Cayman Islands, Baath used the same firm that later set up a money-collecting front for Oliver North. Remember Ollie North, the Iran-Contra affair, and he also served as an intermediary between the Saudis and John Connolly, who, having served as Nixon's Treasury Secretary, began to position himself for a shot at the White House in 1980. In August of 1977, John Connolly and Baath teamed up with Gaith Farhan and bin Mufaz to buy the Main Bank of Houston, a small community bank with about $70 million in assets. Soon the tiny bank began obtaining more than $10 million a month in $100 bills. It was highly irregular for such a tiny bank to require such large amounts of cash. Such unusual transactions can be a sign of money laundering, but bank regulators in Texas said that they did not know why the bank needed the money. The transactions were not illegal, and the reason for them was never revealed. Then in July of 1978, Khalid bin Mufaz and 40 bodyguards took over an entire floor of the Mayflower Hotel in Washington, D.C., with John Connolly there to introduce him to Texas billionaires William Hunt and Nelson Bunker Hunt, and the purpose of the meeting was allegedly to get bin Mufaz and Farhan to participate in the Hunt brothers' quest to corner the world's silver market. The Saudi role in the silver deal fell through, and the Hunt brothers' participation in it led to one of the great financial follies of the decade. Nevertheless, through Main Bank, the young Saudis had established ties to John Connolly. They were now in business with a legitimate presidential contender who seemed well-positioned for the 1980 campaign. For two young men still in their 20s to have business partnerships with an American presidential candidate elevated them enormously in the eyes of the Saudis back home, especially the royal family. With his lantern jaw and silver mane, his Stetson hat and cowboy boots and bolo tie, John Connolly was straight out of Central Casting. He had movie star good looks and a powerful appeal to Wall Street and corporate America. He had survived close ties to the disgraced Nixon presidency and bribery charges in the so-called Milk Fund scandal of 1974. He had even survived the Kennedy assassination in November of 1963, sitting next to John Kennedy in the motorcade. He, too, was shot that day, but emerged as a wounded hero. Now, at the time, John Connolly had only one serious political rival in Texas, and that was George Herbert Walker Bush, a man who possessed little of Connolly's charisma. Whereas Connolly was festooned with the iconography of the Lone Star State, George Bush was a Connecticut Yankee who constantly had to prove his Texas bona fides. Connolly was a po' boy from Floresville in the Texas Hill Country. His father had been a tenant sharecropping farmer who had made his fortune through lucrative relationships with oil barons Sid Richardson and Clint Murchison, and then taken on the trappings of a brash wheeler-dealer himself. By contrast, George Bush was a genuine oil man, but he was an East Coast transplant whose understated style sought to mask but only accentuated his patrician background. A partner in the huge Houston oil industry law firm of Vinson, Elkins, and Connolly, John Connolly was unabashed about being the biggest Arab money lawyer in Texas. Bush kept his distance, and next to Connolly, he seemed bland indeed. For all of that, Bush had mastered one extraordinarily important aspect of politics in a way that left John Connolly and scores of other wannabes in the dust. You see, George Herbert Walker Bush was wired. Whether it be the old moneyed East Coast establishment or Richard Nixon's team, the rising young Turks of the new conservative movement, or the power brokers of the Republican Party infrastructure, George Bush Sr. either knew the right people, or he knew how to meet them and how to make them his friends. He knew people who would enable him to raise campaign funds, to get the right decisions made at government agencies such as the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Export-Import Bank, people who would back his son's oil companies and who would perform favors when called upon. After all, he was from Skull and Bones. He did not like to make decisions without knowing the outcome in advance, from the Petroleum Club in Midland, Texas, to the Bayou Club in Houston, to the Bohemian Grove in California, from chubby men's institutions like the CIA and the oil industry. George Bush had cultivated an extraordinary power base, and in the long run, it was capable of taking him all the way to the White House. And in the short run, within a few years, Saudis seeking access to the highest levels of American power soon forgot Burt Lance, Clark Clifford, and John Connolly. And they realized that George H.W. Bush was the man to see. All right, we're covering the House of Bush, House of Saud. You can get a copy for $26. Probably get it at Barnes & Noble. Remember, it's published by Scribner. Copyright 2004. It's written by Craig Unger. A 1 in 100 read. You'll go a long ways before you find another one. A blockbuster like House of Bush, House of Saud. The ISBN number 07432-5337X. Well, we're just about out of time. The opinions, beliefs, the comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of the network or of this radio station. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Again, georgegordon.org, or call the Law School Direct at 417-273-4900. 67. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived for your listening convenience on the Internet by title and date. Well, there's the signal that says my time is up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. So until then, God willing, of course, good night, friends.